Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I want to cover quite a lot, but I want to take a minute to inform you of the reason there has not been a female guest on my program yet. I want you to know that I've asked five very talented and active women to come on this program, but none of them were willing to do so at this time. It was not because they disapproved of me in any way, but they had reasons. Actually, two didn't even reply, but in all fairness, when you get a lot of emails, as these women probably do, they may have missed it or they delete a lot of things without even looking at them. But I keep trying, and I have another woman in mind, but I just don't want it to appear that I'm not interested in what women have to say, because I am very much. So a couple of items that amazed and or infuriated me recently are the following. First, from the BBC. You know, I may pick on the British a lot, but my God, they now have appointed a special post-Holocaust envoy. This title, if this is the official title, I don't know if it is or not, but if it is, it's really something, post-Holocaust envoy. The BBC says that his job is to make sure the lessons of this terrible period in our history are never forgotten. That's it, isn't it? Never, never forgotten. This honor goes to Sir Andrew Burns, and his resume is really something. It's not surprising. He is the former chairman of the Anglo-Israel Association, which is probably a pretty big thing in Britain, and he is Britain's former ambassador to Israel from 92 to 95. And get this, he's also a former BBC governor. And we know that the BBC and the government, particularly the BBC, is in tight with the whole Holocaust industry in Israel. So the BBC, Sir Andrew, in making his statement, he said this, the UK already plays a leading and active role in promoting Holocaust education, remembrance, and research. In tackling and resolving outstanding issues and claims, and in raising public awareness of the continuing relevance of the lessons and legacies of that terrible moment in European history. That moment, we must keep pushing that terrible moment. All right, you might remember that my second radio program was on Dennis Avey, the British poseur and war veteran who the BBC had set up in conjunction with the Yad Vashem Museum in Israel. And BBC had an article about it. And also they had a video and a clip on their news programs and so on about this story. And they, as I said, are just thick into this business, just as the New York Times is in the United States. That's where all of the official Holocaust industry material is published on a regular basis in the New York Times. But now back to Burns, Sir Burns, he's a sir. He said he wanted to talk to a wide range of experts about all of the issues involved to, quote, develop a properly coordinated and strategic way forward in international discussions. And he said as examples of that, the head of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe, yes, let's keep finding this looted art to give back to the Jews, and the director of the Association of Jewish Refugees. Now, we've still got Jewish refugees, so we're still worried about Jewish refugees. You know, this stuff never ends. Anyway, these two people, these two Jewish heads of these organizations that he was referring to, they also made a statement, and they said, we have worked closely with the government to achieve this historic post. and very much look forward to working with Sir Andrew at this crucial time with several post-Holocaust issues requiring urgent attention and decisive leadership. Well, this means that, of course, this is another Jewish-created government post to advance Jewish interests, and, of course, it's on the British taxpayers' tab. The British taxpayers are paying for another Jewish post to help push Jewish interests. So, well, we have that same thing with some State Department genocide-fighting organizations that we pay for in the United States also. The other little item I wanted to bring up was something that just is kind of, well, this one involves Germany and Christians, the Germans and the Christians, rather than the Brits. And this is about, well, the famous Passion Play in that little town of Oberammergau, Germany. It's a small Alpine town, and since 1635, they have been putting on a Passion Play every 10 years, once a decade. And it's a very elaborate production. It's 6 hours long. And, of course, it's become quite a famous event, a touristy thing, I'm sure. People come from all over to see it. And they did this because they made this vow to God back in 1635 because they were delivered from the bubonic plague, and they attributed it to a favor from God, and so they vowed to produce this play every 10 years. So, in any case, they are supposedly pious Christians who are very devoted to their religion, and yet they have allowed the Jewish Anti-Defamation League to tear their play apart, and the Jewish powers that be to change over the last years, or I don't know how long of a period of time this has been going on, but it's been going on for a while, and they just keep cutting more and more out of it. For example, now the Romans stand guard outside Jesus' first entrance to Jerusalem to make it clear that they are the ones who are really the bad guys here. And the Jewish high priests debate theology, and many side for Jesus in their debate. The infamous blood oath, which is "His blood be upon us and our children," has been axed from the script. And Judas is now more pure at heart. He wants to facilitate dialogue with the priesthood and is duped into betraying Jesus. So when Judas understands that he has been manipulated, he storms the temple demanding Jesus' release. So now the ADL even wrote a new scene in which Jesus stands outside the temple, holds up a Torah scroll, and leads his followers in reciting in Hebrew the major Jewish prayer, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one." A.J. Goldman, in the foreword, says that the play has become less about Jesus and more a rare chance to experience a legendary tradition. This is a good thing, according to him. But even so, for the ADL, it's still not enough. And they attended a preview on May 8th, and they reported that the play continues to depict damaging stereotypes of Judaism and presents Jewish leadership as deceitful, legalistic, vindictive, and xenophobic. Now, Abe Foxman went so far as to say, "Give me another play. If it's about a crucifixion in which the Jews kill Christ, you can never clean it up enough." Of course, Abe Foxman, in a book that he wrote, Never Again, I won't even say what it is, so I don't want to encourage it, but he says, "With every annual reading or reenactment of the story of the death of Jesus in Christian churches, millions of Christians imbibed the notion that the Jews had been guilty of the worst crime in history." I thought that was very ironic and interesting because, of course, Foxman and all of his crowd believe that the Holocaust is the worst crime in history. And as according to my first item that I talked about, of course, they're continually working to make that clear to everyone in the world that the worst crime in history that can never be avenged enough is the Holocaust. And so they cannot have that these Christians still want to think that the worst crime in history may have been the murder of Jesus. So while I have my problems with Christianity, I really have a problem with these Christians. This is a problem I have, that these Christians are bowing down to this Jewish pressure when it comes to their precious religion, which they should hold as inviolate. And if they're the pious Christians that they're supposed to be, and I assume these are Catholics because it comes from way back in 1635. I can't say for sure because I didn't actually check that out. But, you know, this is something they should defend. They should defend this, but they're not defending it. Why is that? Of course, the church that stands behind them is not defending it. That may be the reason. So the people can't do it. But this is a sad state of affairs, ladies and gentlemen. Very sad state of affairs. It's really pathetic. Now for the Elie Wiesel watch. The Wiesel is never out of the news for long. His handlers, his PR firm, he does have one, sees to that. I have just learned that he will be in Charlotte, North Carolina in September for the premiere of a documentary film about 12 Mecklenburg County high school students who went to Europe in 2007 to trace Wiesel's footsteps. Oh boy. We are now tracing his footsteps. What does that remind you of? Yes. Going to the Holy Land and tracing his footsteps, but now it's a Hungarian Jew and it's at Auschwitz. We couldn't make it up. These 12 students, and 12, think of the symbology of that, and high school, they want to get them while they're still young enough, were sponsored by something called the ECHO Foundation, which is a new Charlotte-based organization founded in 1997 to carry on the message that Wiesel brought to the city that year. His message was a call to action for human dignity, justice, and moral courage. Is this not sounding more and more like it's copied directly out of the New Testament? Among the students' stops covered in this film, in the footsteps of Elie Wiesel, are Sighet, Romania, Wiesel's birthplace, Auschwitz and Birkenau, the concentration camps where the young Wiesel and his family were sent, and Versailles, France, where he was given refuge as an orphan. Versailles is where he claims to have lived in France. Boy, that is appropriate. They seem to have thought of everything. At the premiere in September, the 80-year-old Wiesel will engage in an on-stage dialogue with the students after the first public showing of the 56-minute film, which features an introduction by actor Richard Gere. Now, we know that this staged event was carefully planned and orchestrated by the Elie Wiesel PR firm and the ECHO Foundation, which seems to be anonymous at this point, but it's produced by a professional film company with music and lyrics by the cantor of the New York Fifth Avenue Synagogue and an original score by Emmy-winning composer Fred Story. And you know it's not costing these 12 students a dime of their own money to make this pilgrimage. And this, is reminiscent to me of Steven Spielberg's documentary, The Last Days, which is, by the way, not on his list of achievements anymore. I think he is disassociating himself with it. In any event, for this new film, general admission tickets are to go on sale in late summer, so you can start saving up now, folks, but because they're $65. But available right now are patron tickets for $250 and patron packages and corporate sponsorships ranging from $3,000. That's from $3,000. So, you know, the big money is continually being made, and the Wiesel is being set up more and more for absolute worship. So there will be more on this in the future. I will go on now to my main topic for tonight, and that is comparing the Allied-run camps with the German concentration camps. Last week, Dr. Wilhelm Christmann was my guest, and I am just fascinated by what I've learned about the detention camp that he was in. I hope to talk with him a little more about that next week and some other things that we want to talk about, including his recent trip to Europe. But tonight I'm going to talk about two very well-known camps, which are the Dachau and Buchenwald. Both of these camps were turned into Allied camps after the war, after their so-called liberation. Much has been written about them, and many misinterpretations have been given of what actually took place there. And also very little has been written about what happened to those camps under the Allies and what they were like and I intend to show you tonight, that the German camp management was a superior model to what the Allied camp management was. And the people who were there under the Germans were more fortunate than those who were there under the Allies. So we'll start out with Dachau, which is in outside of Munich in the state of Bavaria. And it was the first prison camp that ever opened in the German Reich. And it opened in March 1933. It was set up as a labor camp for male common criminals and political prisoners, mostly communists and resistance workers. Now, before the war, it was those who opposed the regime and just ordinary criminals. But once the war started, it included resistance fighters and resistance workers, many of whom were priests who were political dissidents, and they were very active. Actually, the greatest number of prisoners at Dachau were Polish, but the Germans also made up a large number. Jews were not sent to concentration camps just because they were Jews. That took place after the war was well underway. So at Dachau, the majority of prisoners who died there were Catholics. And as I said, the majority of the prisoners were Poles, Germans, and a scattering of others from here and there. Okay, a difference is that the prisoners of the Nazis had been convicted of a crime and were serving their sentences of a determined length, while the prisoners under the Americans were awaiting trials for completely unspecified crimes. Just generally, they were considered war criminals. So most of these were just released after 3 years internment because no evidence against them was ever found. That was exactly what happened with Dr. Crisman. I don't believe they were looking for any evidence in that case because there was a certain amount of war criminals at his camp, but he was not considered a war criminal. The rest of them, they were just deterred because they were considered maybe a danger to the occupation or something. In the final days of the war, the Jews from these sub-camps were brought to the main camp, along with Jews evacuated from Buchenwald. Now, why weren't these Jews killed, as we are told all the time by the media and books? Because Germany still needed their labor, and because the Nazis didn't have a policy of extermination, but of deportation, and it was no longer possible to deport them. These are the reasons that there were 2,539 Jews at Dachau main camp when it was liberated. They were, for the greatest part, newly arrived prisoners. According to a book now by prisoner Paul Bourbon, who was there during the war years, and this book was used as the official history of Dachau for many years, the following items were for sale in the canteen at Dachau. So I'm going to tell you now some of the conditions that the prisoners lived under, or I might say the privileges that they enjoyed as prisoners at Dachau. Dachau, remember, was a class one camp. The items in the canteen, according to the official history sold at the Dachau Memorial, beetroot jam, oatmeal, sauerkraut, dried vegetables, tinned mussels and fish, cucumbers, condiments, needles and thread, lotions and creams. And now this is also from the official history, I'm quoting. Before the war, the prisoners received adequate food, and even after the war started, the prisoners who worked received extra food to increase output. Certain categories of workers were given a much-appreciated second breakfast called Brotzeit, consisting of an eighth or tenth part of a loaf, and the loaves were pretty big, and 2 ounces of sausage. Well, this sounds much better than the Spam that the prisoners at Wolfsburg got. Continuing to quote, they allowed the clergy in the town of Dachau to collect and send food packages to the camp for the prisoners. Now, I'll bet that included some good stuff. From the end of 1942, however, large consignments of food and other useful things did reach the camp. Food parcels could be sent to the clergy. Germans and Poles particularly received them in considerable quantities from their families, their parishioners, and members of religious communities. This, I'm still quoting from this official book. In Block 26, 100 packages sometimes arrived on the same day. This period of relative plenty lasted until the end of 1944, when the disruption of communication stopped the dispatch of parcels. Nevertheless, the German clergy continued to receive food through the Dean of Dachau, Herr Fonselt, to whom the correspondent sent food tickets The priest bought bread and sausage with these and sent the parcels by the local post. The Red Cross also sent thousands of parcels to Dachau. Well, there are a lot of priests at Dachau because that's where they sent all of the religious peoples, clerics, who were fighting against the Nazi regime. And some of them were very active in the resistance and helping them and helping the Jews and helping the this and, you know, interfering quite a bit. So they were sent to Dachau, but after a short while there, they were given a special place to live, and it was very nice, and they didn't have to work. They were really treated too well, in a way, because they didn't really deserve it, but they got better food. They even got a third of a liter of wine every day, each one of them, all for themselves. They could read, and they could do what they wanted within their own, all that free time they had. But the public, you know, of course, the German people and the Polish people, they were so concerned about their priests, so they were constantly sending them stuff, and they even sent them their own food vouchers. And then the priests were able to use these food vouchers to get even more food for themselves, which they did. And they are not known to have shared it with anybody else, not that they could, but later, at certain times when they could, they didn't seem to do so. But in any case, some other things about Dachau. Actually, it was a model camp. Visitors were frequently given a tour. This is the years before World War II. Including American prison officials came there to look at it and see how it was being run. It was really quite amazing. Heinrich Himmler, who was in charge of the camps then, and overall, he had a college degree in agriculture, and he was very interested in natural farming and natural food and all things natural. And he established a large farm outside the camp where some of the prisoners worked. It was an experimental agriculture that was taking place there in their farms and gardens, and herbs were grown for use as medicine, and vitamins were extracted from the plants. This prison system was a part of all this. This wasn't the only place where they had these kinds of farms and gardens. The only concentration camp, Birkenau, was another example. But this one was going on for a lot longer. So all through the 30s, things like this. Fermented blackberry and raspberry leaves from the Dachau farm were used to create German tea, reducing dependency on imports. Work was done on growing German pepper, and gladiola flowers were grown in great quantities for their vitamin C. The gladioli leaves were dried and pulverized and combined with a mixture of spices, beef, fat, and cooking salt to make a food supplement for SS soldiers. Himmler was way ahead of his time in his knowledge of plants that could be used as medicine. He planted fields of primroses in a first attempt to extract evening primrose oil for use as medication. Now, this was typical of Germany as a whole at this time. They were really making inroads. They were very interested in using nature, natural methods, and finding vitamins, minerals, and all sorts of food supplements in natural form in plants. So on this Dachau farm, they also had herds of cows. There was 1,850 acres of pastures, and they were tended by up to 800 inmates who were, one of their jobs in tending the cows was gathering the dung for use in the camp gardens. They made a special compost to speed the growth of their herbs and their experimental plants, and they also were doing experiments using worms to improve the soil. So this was a lot better way to spend your time as a prisoner out in tending cows and so on. Even if you were gathering dung, that's not so bad. In doing useful, worthwhile things, which is a great contrast to what the prisoners were doing under the Allies. So beginning in 1943, now we're well into the war, they set up 123 subcamps near the Dachau main camp. These subcamps were kind of new. They were there because of the war, and they were industrial manufacturing sites that included some very important underground airplane factories. On April 9th, 1945, now this was right before the Americans arrived, a bomb had hit the camp, knocking out a water main and the source of electricity for the camp. And from then on, there was no running water in the camp, and their drinking water had to be brought in by trucks. There was no water for the showers, nor any water to flush the toilets. So you can see the kind of things that happened at the end to create the conditions that were there when the Americans arrived. It's almost like, I think the people at the top must have known. They must have had some, you know, they weren't that stupid. They must have had some idea of what they were doing and what effect it was going to have on what they found all over Germany when they got there, including these camps. And yet they pretended like all of this terrible situation that they discovered there was the result of German sadism and Nazi sadism and purposeful, hateful treatment of the prisoners, which was not the case. So once the Americans took over the camp, as soon as they got all of the prisoners out, which took a little while, but not too long, it was turned into a war crimes enclosure number one for 30,000 Germans who had been arrested as war criminals and were awaiting trial by an American military tribunal. 30,000. Most of these were there for 3 years and were not released until 1948 because of lack of evidence. Some were transferred to France for trial. The survivors of Dachau under the Americans claimed that the German prisoners were treated harshly and denied their rights under the Geneva Convention. This is absolutely true. Many accused the Americans of torture. Well, the military tribunals, which they called trials, but were not real trials because they didn't follow the rules of trials as far as the protection of the defendants goes, they were held right there on the grounds of Dachau. They had their buildings and their signs put up and so on, and they were doing the interrogations of these prisoners right there. And this began in November 1945. And while they were interned there, all these Germans did not work. They had nothing to occupy their time. They had nothing to do. There were no more orchestras, soccer games, no brothel as when the Nazis were there, as when the Nazis ran it. There had been a 15,000 book library for prisoners that was removed and taken to the town of Dachau and set up in a building there. So, you know, these prisoners were considered not worthy of anything. And I don't know how they were fed, but I guess they didn't die of starvation. But they were not treated as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention, but as war criminals. So, therefore, they didn't have too many rights. We're going to continue with the discussion of the Dachau camp as war criminals enclosure number one, and then we're going to go on. I'm going to contrast the Buchenwald camp with what took place under the Allies, actually the Soviets, right after that was liberated. So stay tuned and we'll continue.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
It's the oil spill that never ends, and the finger pointing that doesn't seem to stop either.
BP made choices that set safety aside in exchange for cost-cutting and time-saving decisions.
8 weeks into the disaster, Americans can't get enough of this man, CEO of BP, Tony Hayward.
He's guilty because he killed 11 workers, and he is a major cause for this oil spill.
And no matter how much Hayward tries to revamp his company's image...
The Gulf spill is a tragedy that never should have happened. I'm Tony Hayward. BP has taken full responsibility for cleaning up the spill in the Gulf.
It's a message that might be falling on deaf ears.
Good evening, America. I'm Tony Hayward, CEO of British Petroleum. And I'm here this evening to tell you all to suck it.
Today, Hayward faced some of Washington's toughest critics in what has been called the public execution of the man in charge.
We could find no evidence that you paid any attention to the tremendous risks BP was taking. We've reviewed 30,000 pages of documents from BP, including your emails. There is not a single email or document that shows you paid even the slightest attention to the dangers at this well.
Mr. Hayward, you owe it to all Americans. We are not small people, but we wish to get our lives back. for the Americans who live and work on the Gulf Coast. It may be years before they get their lives back. For the Americans who lost their lives on the rigs, their families may never get their lives back. Mr. Hayward, I'm sure you will get your life back and with a golden parachute back to England. But we in America are left with the terrible consequences of BP's reckless disregard for safety.
And of course, whenever there's a grilling of a CEO in public, there's a media circus not too far behind, armed and ready to show the American public what's going down.
It's a scene that seems eerily familiar to one American saw play out just a few months ago. In the midst of the financial crisis, it was Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, with the bullseye on his back.
I am the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Time to put some guys in jail. Time for a little justice.
And who could forget the big three auto CEOs who flew into town on private jets when they came to ask lawmakers for a bailout from the taxpayers?
It's almost like seeing a guy show up at the soup kitchen and high hat and tuxedo.
And as much as Americans love to hate those they believe are responsible for today's messes,
there's no one who wants this thing over more than I do. You know, I'd like my life back.
In some cases, it might be even better to watch them in the line of fire. Priya Sridhar, RT, Washington, D.C.
Beat me on the chest. Why did you let it happen, she asked. It changed.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and as I was saying before the break, the Americans took over the Dachau concentration camp that had been run by the Germans and put the Germans that they considered to be potential war criminals in it. And these war criminals remained there for 3 years while they were doing these tribunals and even afterwards. But most of them, they didn't find any evidence to prosecute them. And they were released. Not all of them were released, but some, but a lot of them were released. They had 30,000 of them. So once these war criminals were all released, the Dachau barracks were renovated, and they became the home for 5,000 homeless ethnic German refugees from Czechoslovakia who lived there until 1964. So now Germany was back, supposedly, as a republic with its own government, and they had all these homeless Germans that had been kicked out of the Eastern European countries, where they had lived for many centuries, and Germany was, of course, smaller than it had been, and it was filled with all these German refugees, and so they were looking for places to live. And these ones from Czechoslovakia, or what became the Czech Republic, were given the Dachau barracks. And these were among the luckier ones. They would have remained even longer, but for an organization of there was communist camp survivors that began demanding their removal, so that they could turn these barracks and turn this place into a memorial in honor of themselves. That's how I put it, themselves. They were these survivors, and they now wanted to kick all these people, homeless people out, and not who were Germans, and not let them live there because they wanted to make this Dachau memorial, which is what we have there today, a memorial museum, and run by these communist organizations, or a communist organization. That's who runs it. Most of whom are not even German. I can't say that for sure, but that's my I suspect that. Some of this comes out of Sweden, Switzerland. I don't know some of these places where this organization is actually headquartered. But we have a great many acres there. I've been there, and there's really nothing of much importance there. But it's absolutely free to get into. The other camp I want to talk about is Buchenwald, which was established in July 1937 for the purpose of providing materials for the building projects that Adolf Hitler planned. Now, Buchenwald is outside of Weimar in the state province of Thuringia, I think it is. And it's in the central eastern part of Germany, and it became part of East Germany, what was East Germany, after the Iron Curtain came down. But the Germans established it because it had a quarry there, and they were in need of building materials. You know, Hitler was going to completely rebuild Berlin, and he also wanted to redesign and rebuild important parts of Linz, Austria, because Linz is the town he considered his hometown, and he had, from his youth, he had ideas that how to improve Linz and make it a more beautiful and important-looking place, and so that now he had his chance to do that. So this site, as I said, had a stone quarry, and also Plaszow and Mauthausen. Plaszow is the camp that is featured in Schindler's List, and Mauthausen in Austria also were set up in the same year, 1937, because they had stone quarries and they were to be used to provide building materials. So this shows you what Adolf Hitler was thinking about in 1937, not war, but what he called tasks of peace. The first prisoners in all these camps were what were called professional criminals who had already served two sentences for crimes that they had committed. A new law was passed in 1937 that these professional criminals had to go to a concentration camp. Buchenwald was not designated a labor camp, but it was designated a concentration camp, and it was a Class 2 camp. In my book, Auschwitz, the Underground Guided Tour, which I talked about on a previous program, I explained that Auschwitz and Dachau were both Class 1 camps, and they had the Arbeit macht frei motto on their entrance gate. At Buchenwald, the words on the gate were Jedem's das sein, literally, to each his own, but figuratively, everyone gets what they deserve, what he deserves. And that's what was on the Class 2 camps. The difference between the two types of camps is one is that these prisoners at Buchenwald were not as likely to be released as the ones in Dachau and Auschwitz. After the war started, the prisoners that were sent there were mainly communist political prisoners and members of the resistance, as still almost all men. And these were tough hombres. Oh, I mean, there are pictures of them, and all you have to do is look at some of the pictures to see that. These were not people you're going to trust when you looked the other direction. Particularly because they were mostly communists, and these communists were very organized. They were very political. They had strong ideas. They were not the laid-back kind that just went along with what was. But Buchenwald was a pretty nice place to be at, because even though it was Class 2, the prisoners were treated in some ways better than at Dachau. This camp had a zoo, which was built in 1938 by the first commandant, Karl Otto Koch. But though the zoo could be seen by the prisoners, only the guards could actually visit it. It was built for the guards, because being a camp guard is not the most enjoyable job, you have to realize. I think we all realize that. And so this commandant tried to do something. You know, they tried to make some kind of pleasantries for the guards so that they don't lift their spirits a little bit, I guess. And Koch was an animal lover, and he insisted that the animals be treated kindly. So he didn't want anybody going in there and doing anything bad to them. But the inmates also had a movie theater that showed full-length regular movies, not propaganda films. The admission charge was 30 pfennigs, and it was later reduced to 20 pfennigs. This brings up the fact that the prisoners could receive money from relatives outside the camp. And they also earned money from work in the camp. So outside money was exchanged for camp scrip. But I don't know when that started. It started, I think, in 1943. And at that time, it may have been even then that both regular money and camp scrip could be used. But we know that the money was used in the canteen. Yes, we learned from the official Buchenwald guidebook, and the canteen is there now, that many prisoners had the opportunity to buy some item. I'm quoting from the guidebook. Many prisoners had the opportunity to buy some items of additional everyday need since the first years of the camp's existence. In addition to cash money, prisoners were also entitled to pay for goods with shopping vouchers of fixed value, which were issued from autumn 1943 on. Now, this was a form of camp money. This was the scrip, I think they called shopping vouchers. Even today, this canteen building is there. It was constructed in 1943. It's large and quite attractive. It must have more purposes than just the canteen, because it seems to be too big for just that. But along with the money to spend in the camp, the prisoners could receive packages containing cigarettes, chocolate, oranges, and other items. This is the type of thing that was most popular, it seems, with prisoners. They wanted plenty of cigarettes. They wanted chocolate. That was a special thing. Things like oranges, fruit, you know, fruit that would not go bad in the sending was very desirable. And, of course, anything sweet, sugar, special treats. But they could get all that. They could get as much as was sent to them, as a matter of fact. And in the basement of the canteen, the prisoners made soap. They had a little soap factory from animal fat for the use of the camp inmates. So this is how rumors got started about making soap from human fat, I suppose, because they did make soap in the camps. And, you know, soap making was so traditional among Germans. It was just a normal, natural thing. In fact, I remember seeing, I have a good memory that I kind of cherish, seeing my German grandmother making soap in her basement, her own basement. And I certainly didn't think that she had murdered the neighbors to do so. Soap making was common. And, of course, they used a lot of soap to try to keep the prisoners clean. And they had a laundry, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But also, prisoners were given a haircut every 2 months. That was another rule they had. There was one group of prisoners called Night and Fog that could not receive letters or packages, but all the other prisoners could. I think this Night and Fog group was like the NKVD political commissars that they would capture. These were the really tough communist political operators, and so they had to be kept separate, and these were the serious bad guys who they kept separate from the others. And they could not be allowed to get mail or packages, because, you know, it was just too dangerous what they might include. So, according, again, to the Buchenwald report, which may be the same as this Buchenwald guidebook, the prisoners had a camp library with 13,811 books. They were also allowed to organize variety shows and concerts. Artwork was encouraged as long as it was not degenerate art. And some of the prisoners' paintings were shown in the museum art gallery. And so, this is just like at Auschwitz. This is like at every Nazi concentration camp. Also, they had a camp orchestra made up of inmate musicians who wore red pants and green vests at Buchenwald. This represented the colors of the two main groups in the camp, the colors that they wore to identify themselves, the communists and the German criminals. I'm sure the communists were red and the Germans were green. The communists also had their own orchestra, which played communist songs. I mean, in Buchenwald, it was really run by the communist internees, because there were so many, and they were such a strong, forceful group. I mean, they were very organized. They were good at taking over. And so the camp authorities just pretty much, in order to keep the camp going, well, they just had to let those communists run things. And as long as they were running it, they weren't causing too much problem. But they were quite a tough group, and they were not that nice to the non-communists, and that was kind of a sad effect of these communists being in control, because a lot of prisoners were mistreated, and they were mistreated by these communist bloc leaders and capos and so on, and not by the Nazi guards. Another facility which was common to all the main concentration camps that was there at Buchenwald was a camp brothel. And the Americans, when they arrived at Buchenwald, they found 15 prostitutes in the brothel. There was also a soccer field for the prisoners, and the prisoners had boxing matches. I'm not making this up. This is all known in the way it was, but it just is never mentioned. No, that it can't be denied, but it is never talked about. Instead, we know what's talked about all the time. So they had everything at Auschwitz except a swimming pool. I mean, they had everything that Auschwitz had, but they didn't have a swimming pool. There were some other camps that had what looked like swimming pools or some kind. They may have been irrigation pools, or not air, but water holes of some kind, but they could have been used as swimming pools. But Buchenwald didn't have that. But Buchenwald may not have had as nice a buildings as Auschwitz had. But they had all the activities. So I should also mention the prisoner's laundry, which was next to the Goethe's Oak. All camps had laundries, and naturally, this is probably where they used all that soap that they made. The prisoners' cleanliness was not only encouraged, but it was enforced. But at Buchenwald, there was a famous oak called Goethe's Oak next to the prisoners' laundry, and this was Johann Wolfgang Goethe, the great German philosopher, writer, and poet, and tremendous intellectual. And this was supposedly a place that he enjoyed coming to, because he lived in Weimar much of his life. But, you know, it was destroyed, utterly destroyed, this oak tree, by an American bomb in the last months of the war. And today it's just a stump. So that's another casualty of the vicious type of Allied bombing that Germany experienced. Now back to the camp, there's a picture of the inside of the kitchen at Buchenwald. There's very hard to find any pictures from these camps from at that time inside a building. But there is one inside the kitchen there, or one of the kitchens, with huge kettles in it. They look like big drums with these lids propped up above them, and a few people standing there, where obviously lots of food was prepared. The prisoners, I have to tell you, and you should notice that when the Americans took over, all these pictures that they took of these liberated prisoners, they were exceptionally healthy looking at Buchenwald. They were smiling. They were not thin. They looked quite vigorous. And on the other group of prisoners that we're shown all the time were the sick ones, the ones who were dying of typhus and other diseases, or they were already dead and had not been able to be cremated or buried because of the total destruction and confusion that was going on at the end. They didn't have anything to cremate them with. They didn't have any fuel. They didn't have any wood. They didn't have much of anything. So they didn't have much food either, but no one was being purposely starved. And you can see that from the majority of the so-called survivors. And there were a lot of youths and children at Buchenwald, and they were kept separately. And pictures of them, they look quite healthy. And parents and children were there together in amongst some groups. So this is the story of Buchenwald under the Nazis. Now, on July 3rd, 1945, the American Army turned the Buchenwald concentration camp over to the Soviet Union, and they renamed it the NKVD, well, I don't know if that was part of the name, but that's what it was, NKVD Special Camp Number 2. They put German political prisoners into it. So there was, again, you have the switchover. And according to the Potsdam Agreement, which they were all going by, it said this: Nazi party chiefs, influential followers of the Nazis, and the management of the Nazi offices and organizations, and any other person who is dangerous to the occupation and its aims, shall be arrested and interned. Now, that one phrase, any other person who is dangerous to the occupation and its aims. So whoever was they considered an enemy of their occupation, they could put them into these camps. That the previous to that, the Germans had put those who were dangerous to their aims and their occupation or their war effort or their nation. So it's this tit for tat here. But how these people were treated, in the very first month, 1,392 persons were interned in this special camp number 2. By the end of 1945, just the end of that first year, there were 6,000 in the camp, and there are no records showing the reason for any of the arrests. During the 5 years of its existence, from 45 to 1950, 28,500 people were interned, all Germans, of course, in special camp number 2. And this included about 1,000 women. Some of them had very small children with them, and some of these children died. Lots of people died there. But I'm going to tell you about that. But first, according to the Buchenwald guidebook, which is not trying to whitewash too much the Soviet camp, but when I was there, of course, the big attraction is the Nazi camp. And then, if you look hard, you can find that they show you where you can go to go through a path in the woods to see the Soviet camp, or where they buried all the, not so much the camp, but where they had these mass graves And also they have a museum there about the Soviet camp. But it's nothing like what they have for the Nazis. And I didn't even go and look at it because I didn't want to particularly see it. I knew what it would be, but this is the way they do it. But at this, they have a guidebook, and this is what they say about the Soviet camp, the conditions there. I'm just picking out the highlights here. Overcrowding, vermin, cold, no clothing was issued, not possible to replace worn-out clothes or broken shoes. Bad sanitary conditions caused a large number of skin diseases and edema, in addition to tuberculosis and dystrophy. People were undernourished. Hunger was omnipresent. Mass deaths ensued when the already restricted rations were cut temporarily. That was in the winter of 1946 and 47, when the rations were at the minimum, and they cut them even further, so hunger was reached its lowest level and people starved to death. Complete isolation from the outside world. This is one of the worst. No contact whatsoever with relatives by letter or visits. Nothing. No newspapers, no nothing. No radio, no nothing. Enforced idleness and a lack of any positive prospects caused depression and other psychological diseases. They had nothing to do. Nothing to do but lay around in these barracks. No minimum standard of detention either. They didn't know how long they would be there. They didn't know what their future was. Nothing was done to find out the guilt of individuals by which many might have gained their liberation. The mortality rate was higher, of course, than when it was under the Nazis, or under in any Nazi camps. And according to the camp records kept by the Soviet Union's records, of all the Soviet camp system in Germany, approximately one-third of the internees died in the camps. One-third. When they died, over 7,000 who died in this special camp number 2 at Buchenwald, and they were buried in mass graves in the woods, which is what they show you there, and the relatives did not receive any notification of their deaths. You know, these people took them forever to find out what happened to their loved ones. So some of the prisoners at this camp were transferred to the Soviet Union. They didn't release them. And the largest group left in February 1947. In 1950, the Soviets handed Buchenwald over to the East German Ministry of Internal Affairs, which was just another communist secret service or secret police organization. So then it was used by the East Germans as a prison for their prisoners. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of my presentation here of comparing the camps of Dachau and Buchenwald under the Nazis and under the Allies. And next week, I want very much to compare the Wolfsburg camp, which is considered to be a very mild place, with Auschwitz, which is considered to be the premier death camp and place of horror of all the Nazi creations. So tune in next week and we will talk about that and some other very interesting things. For tonight, good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.